Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 344th episode of Awards Chatter, the Hollywood Reporter's awards podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a Vietnam vet who returned from that war after 15 months of service with two wounds and a Bronze Star, and subsequently became one of the most talented and controversial writers, directors, and all-around filmmakers of his generation. Indeed, among other titles, he wrote but did not direct 1978's Midnight Express, 1983's Scarface, and 1985's Year of the Dragon. He wrote and directed 1986's Salvador and Platoon, 1987's Wall Street, 1989's Born on the 4th of July, 1991's The Doors and JFK, 1994's Natural Born Killers, 1995's Nixon, 1999's Any Given Sunday, 2006's World Trade Center, and 2016's Snowden. And he directed but did not write 2008's W and 2010's Wall Street, Money Never Sleeps, as well as documentaries about, and with the cooperation of, Fidel Castro, Hugo Chavez, and Vladimir Putin. The winner of three Oscars, one for writing, recognizing his adaptation of Midnight Express, and two for directing, in recognition of his work on Platoon and Born on the 4th of July, he has been described by The Guardian as, quote, a sort of latter-day Ernest Hemingway, an action man with a reputation for women and drugs, close quote. And ever since his film JFK made famous the skeptical phrase, quote, back into the left, close quote, almost 30 years ago, he has also been seen by some as a conspiracy nut, and by others as a rare truth teller. In any event, he is now the author of an acclaimed new memoir about his life, from his privileged childhood, through his time at war, through Oscar night in 1987, entitled Chasing the Light. I'm talking, of course, about the legendary Oliver Stone. Over the course of our conversation, the 73-year-old and I discussed why he volunteered for Vietnam, how he was changed by his time there, and how it inspired his work after coming home, much of which has been about characters who do not realize what they are getting into until it is too late to get out. Why it took 10 years for each of his two Vietnam-related scripts, Platoon and Born on the 4th of July, to get made into movies, and why, despite being one of Hollywood's hottest writers in the intervening years, he was not content until he, quote, got to make the movie I wanted to make, close quote. Why, since JFK, he has often felt misunderstood and misrepresented in the media, with so many of his films, in his view, prejudged as political or controversial and never really given a fair hearing, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Oliver, thank you so much for doing this. It's great to have you on the podcast. And congratulations on this new book, Chasing the Light, which is really beautifully written. I never knew that I could care so much about your parents and your childhood and things outside of the movies, but I really do. And I guess I just to begin with, can you talk a little bit about what motivated you to write this and what the process was like of doing it?
Well, I have to say, you know, that everywhere I went in the world, selling the movies, traveling, people always keep asking a lot of the same questions about how did you start? How did you get in this business? How many scripts did you write? When did you sell your first script? How did you get to direct? These are basic questions that people are interested in who are younger, who are thinking about trying a movie business, which is very exotic to many people because it's, as it was to me, I didn't know how do you make movies? I had no idea. That's one reason, but I have to say, honestly, the main reason is to know myself better.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is what writing is about. I've always been a writer. I was a writer, as you can see in the book, very young. My father encouraged me to write for money, which was good, good motivation to get comic books. And I wrote a novel when I was 19 years old, which has marked my life deeply, actually, because it was very personal. It was my first expression of myself to myself, where I, in a sense, a young man sometimes doesn't know he exists. He's always being funneled from one school to the next, one institution. And, you know, it's difficult. America is as privileged a society as it is, and for me it was, at the same time, you don't get much of an identity from school. I mean, you tend to be shipped, you tend to be cataloged. And as you know, this was compounded by my parents' divorce. We were a small family, three people, and we found each other separated from each one another. And it was a very tough time for me at 15. It was sort of like being thrown out into the cold. David Copperfield kind of thing. All of a sudden, my mother, father, who I thought loved each other, in fact, had a very tempestuous relationship, very much so. I would call it a magical childhood turned cold, stark, freezing cold. And it's a strange thing to fall apart, a family to fall apart. It really means that you live separately. So when I wrote the book at 19, coming back from Vietnam for my first time, extended time abroad like that, I'd been a teacher and then for two terms in a school. And then I was in the Merchant Marine as a wiper. Mm-hmm. And I traveled around Asia at 19. I learned about life. And I wrote this book because, as I said in the book, it proved my existence to myself that I had feelings and I could put them on paper.
Right.
The book was rejected. And that set up part two of this journey as a young man. The book was rejected by the publisher and I wanted to kill myself, but I couldn't do it. So I went to Vietnam instead. Right.
Which was,
that's a long and short.
Yeah. And could have very easily achieved that aim. I mean, it was, and you write very vividly about your time there, but first, I guess let's just go back and talk about, you were, you know, there were some people who, including the President of the United States, who did everything they could to get out of Vietnam. You did everything you could to get into it, which may surprise people because you had been accepted to Yale University after this period when you were kind of in turmoil because of your parents' divorce. You had very bright prospects there, and yet you chose to, after that initial trip to Vietnam where you were teaching, you chose to try to go back as an infantryman to volunteer for the draft. Can you just share for people who haven't yet read the book, just to give them a little flavor, what was the reason to do that beyond frustration with your parents?
Well, I think I described in the book that I was burned out, that the boarding school, 4 years in a boarding school was very tough, a cold existence. It was nothing I was used to. And I had to adapt to become, I had to become like everybody else. I had to compete against everybody else and join a way of life that is very East Coast, let's say, or I would say, you know, very disciplined. And I suppose I was bound for Wall Street, my father's world, although I was not really adept at mathematics like he was, nor was I as intelligent as he was. I was dead inside. That's all I can say. I was burned out. And I think that's a common thing when you're actually at that age. If you read, which was one of the most popular books at that time, was Catcher in the Rye, that sums up a mentality of somebody who, with given all these chances, you know, you think, wow, what an education. But unless you appreciate it, you can't get anything out of it. The opposite, it becomes cynical, you become stale, you become a lot of those things that you hate, you end up hating. Which I tie that to your statement about these people who missed the draft. I mean, there's no, I was in the class at Yale with George W. Bush, who I made a movie about too.
Yes, yes.
He was his freshman year with me. But those types exist everywhere I went. They were the, call them the rich kids, the privileged kids. Bush, we know, had an Air National Guard deferment, which he violated, basically. And then they go to war, these guys. These are the guys who end up going to war. Bill Clinton bombs all these places. He doesn't go to the draft. Neither does Donald Trump. I mean, Donald Trump at least didn't. Well, he's talking about nuclear weapons and throwing military might around and all that shit. And Trump never went either. So this tells you a lot about my generation. Don't condemn us all as a bunch of spoiled kids. I mean, a lot of us did care and fought for good things.
Right.
I tried. I mean, from my bad experience in Vietnam, rough one, I learned a lesson and I tried to share it with the rest of the world to some degree, you know, like avoid bad wars, you know, but of course we did. No one listened and we had several more. But listen, as I said earlier, I wanted to end it. It couldn't go on the way it was. I would never be an East Coast product like my father, who went to Yale. I would never be that. I didn't know what I wanted to be. but I just wanted to be away from it all. I wanted, as I wrote somewhere in the book, the pirate life, kind of like a life that was different than this one. I'd go to sea like they used to do in the old days and find a new way of existence, or I'd become a pirate like Captain Blood or something. And I didn't know what I wanted. I found there is a lot of suicide from among adolescents, a lot more than people admit. At 18, 19, people don't take it seriously. They think it's a young person, blah, blah, blah. But you know, any parent knows how difficult it is to negotiate your way through those years. And that was sort of what Child's Night Dream was about. It was about those years. Now, I'm an older man. I'm talking about a book that's about the first 40 years. But as part of that 40 years, I pay homage to the difficulty of negotiating adolescence. Catcher in the Rye again, a very difficult period, time in your life. All that anguish is in the first book. But I sum it up quickly here because it's part of what happens to my career later in life. What do I become? I become, after Vietnam, I know nothing. I know how to shoot a gun. I know how to blow a boiler. I know how to bivouac. I know how to camp in the jungle. But I don't have any skills for life. So I come back to America. I'm numb. I'm alienated. I'm just, for it takes me about a year to put myself together enough to go back to some kind of organized society. Thank God I met a woman whom I married eventually, who helped me negotiate my way back to civilization, because I was a barbarian when I came back. I was outside society.
But not without reason. I mean, I don't want people to go without knowing that. So you reported for duty, I think, September 15th, 67. You're in Vietnam for 15 months, total of three different units, wounded twice. And as you write in the book, even, you're very, you know, candid about it, you know, killed at least one man who you've talked about the impact that has on a person. But the way you described it, I thought the whole, I think a portion of the time there, you wrote, quote, "It was exciting. It was as if I'd passed on from this world and was somewhere where the light was being specially displayed to me in a preview of another life. Soldiers might say it was hell, but I saw it as divine. The closest man would ever come to the Holy Spirit was to witness and survive this great destructive energy," close quote. So when you came back at the end of 1968, you mentioned the problems that came with that. Were there positive things as well that you took away from your time there, or was it something that just had detrimental effects?
Well, the thing you read from the book is actually positive. He's like saying it was the most exciting thing I'd ever seen. It was like I went to heaven or something. The light, what you see in that battle, that happened on January 1, 1968. It's funny how the dates collide sometimes. The date that I went over, you didn't mention it, September 15, 1967, was actually my 21st birthday. We get on the airplane around close to midnight at Oakland, and boom, you hit the dateline a few hours later, not very long, and that was my birthday. It was gone. It was chopped into the Pacific. So I was never really 21. I went from... I never had that birthday. January 1968, that battle... What I tried to say, it's a massive... It was the biggest battle I was in, and I describe it in detail because it's a strange battle where we end up with 400 enemy casualty dead, plus all their wounded. Well, we didn't see their wounded. They're dead. And we had 150 wounded and 25 dead. So it was some battle. It went on all night. I'd never seen such fireworks in my life. And yet the irony is I never saw a single enemy during that whole night, nor did I fire a bullet, nor did I do anything except move around the perimeter and get blown off my feet by a beehive round, which concussed me. So it's a strange battle, but I'm trying to say that nothing is what you think it is. When you're over there, the reason they bring young men there is young men don't know. We don't have the same awareness that an older man has. So I didn't realize what I was involved in. I just saw all these dead bodies. You know, it was strange. It was just different. But I didn't empathize the way that I could now as an older man. So I'm saying the young don't know, and you don't realize and that's why the book really liberates to a sense that for me, and you go back and you say, what did this mean? And I examined Vietnam in detail about what the body meant, what the lies were of that war, what friendly fire means, what killing villagers mean, And above all, the biggest lie of all, which was the United States is winning this war, which they kept feeding us and feeding the public, by the way. These are very important points in my life, lies. As in the Kennedy killing, which a year or so before that, you know, I don't get into that, but it sets the tone of the lies. And of course, in my own private life with my divorced parents, it turns out that my 15 years prior to that is a lie.
Has been a lie.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So in a way, my life is about living, fighting back against the lie. And people think I'm nuts, you know, like I'm making up things. But there is a lot of truth to trying to find out why we have to live with this hypocrisy.
Sure.
And one more point is, and I try to make it in the army scenes, older men don't mix with war. It's not a good thing. That's why a lot of the sergeants who were older from World War II, Korea, they were the leaders, basically. And there were some officers, but I didn't run into many. The sergeants were lifers. Those that were lifers would stay, most of them, in the rear, because you get good bonuses in the rear, combat pay, and you go out here and there. But you don't risk your life when you've seen a couple of wars. You know better. They let that go to the draftees and the younger ones too. And often the guys who got killed quickly were the guys who just came in, you see. The NFGs, the new fucking guy, they called them.
Yes. So you come back to the States, as you say, you kind of had that year of floundering around when you did marry the slightly older woman, and I believe you're at that point.
No, I didn't marry her in that year. I just met her.
Met her in that year and eventually married. Yeah. You loved writing, but you didn't want to write another novel. You liked photography, which was something you had been able to do while you were in Vietnam, but there was no real career in that. And so screenwriting, in a sense, and going to NYU to film school essentially was a compromise, right?
Yeah. Well, I stayed in New York and I had a crazy year. I fought with my father, who was, you know, pro-war, pro-Vietnam. So there was a lot of that going on. And my mother, and there was LSD trips. There was all kinds of craziness. I was lost, in a sense. But I did learn a new world. It was a new world to me. Everybody was scrambling around in the late 60s, like they are now, because they're for their careers, for their money, for themselves. You know, it was a very prosperous time. Johnson threw open the money, the gates. Lyndon Johnson. Anyway, people were out for themselves. So there was no interest in the war. I can't say they were against the war. I can't say people even gave a shit. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, people talk about you're a baby killer. I never heard that kind of stuff. People didn't care. They were detached from it. Oh, yeah, you went to Vietnam? Wow, why'd you do that? You know, like puzzled. It was more like George Bush asking me, why'd you go to Vietnam? You didn't have to. You could have had it. You could have gone to college, you could have all that shit. You know, I could have gone to a psychiatrist, paid him. That's the kind of cynicism I'd run away from. I didn't know what I wanted. I didn't want that. So I was never a careerist that way. But what happened was that a friend of mine had said, why don't you just go to film school? You know, you can fuck around. You know, you can watch films. It's not going to be that hard. And you get, plus I get the GI Bill. You know, I got 90% of my tuition or so was paid. So I went. And I started to dip in. Writing kept me sane. Writing. I wrote a screenplay right away. My first screenplay I wrote right when I came back. I bought a screenplay book, you know, How to Do It. And because the form was new. It was interesting. I loved movies. My mom always loved movies. My dad, too. He took me to the movies. He used to argue. My dad would take me to the movie. He used to argue with me after we'd seen a good movie. He said, well, what do you think of that plot point or this plot point? And he would always point out the illogic of a plot. He'd always find a hole, of which there are always in movies. And I'd argue back and he'd argue. And then at the end, he'd say, well, you see, we could have made it better. We could have made it. And I remember that. So that he gave me my first encouragement at the age of 7 to be a screenwriter. We could have made it better. In other words, and that's true about movies. People go to movies. You always hear it. You know what I'm talking about. You always blame the director. You say, oh, you know, he fucked that up. I could have done it better.
And the truth, though, is that, you know, you mentioned that little bit of encouragement from your father, but there wasn't widespread encouragement at all throughout your life up to that point when you're in film school. And now Martin Scorsese, who happens to be one of your teachers, has you show a you know, has the student show a student film, each of you, and I guess most of them are getting picked apart by the students and the professor. And he says to you what?
He says to me, he says to the class, after this nutty film I made, which was really experimental, but after about 12, 13 minutes of it finished, I thought, you know, boy, they're going to rip me apart like a Chinese cultural revolution. You know, they're going to put a dunce hat on my head. And he just said, wow, that's a filmmaker, to the class. That's a filmmaker. And he says, you see, he's keeping it personal. It matters to him. He cares. And he lets us know that through his care, we care. And there was some beautiful truth to that. And it, of course, stilled all the criticism of the film. And it was like my graduation ceremony. It was my first year there. He said, you're a film, you know, he implied that I had a future. I don't think most of the kids there did, because most of them didn't go on. But it was a tough time, because there were no jobs, basically, in the industry. It was just all beginning. This stuff was beginning. So people were going out of film school with no degree, with degrees, but no jobs. And that's what happened to me, too.
Yeah, so you graduate, there's no real work, you're now driving a cab, you do now marry this slightly older woman, and then it seems like there was a real turning point for you that maybe most people wouldn't have even recognized, that would have passed them by, but you felt the worst thing that could happen would be for you to just be comfortable. And I wonder why you think you recognized that it was necessary to leave your marriage, to leave New York, and to really go full-fledged into being a screenwriter.
Well, you're getting ahead of yourself, but that's what happens, yes. First of all, you know, beside the jobs, cab driving, and advertising job, production assistant on several films, a porno among them, I raise money, I make a film, as a low-budget horror film, Seizure, in Canada with two partners. We get killed on this, but it was an adventure beyond belief, like somewhat like Salvador later. And then I write, you know, at least eight to 12 screenplays in that period, or maybe more, and treatments. I keep writing because writing was in my conscience. And by the way, at film school, I'm one of the few students who actually went to screenwriting class. I was shocking to me that so many of those kids that were there were not that interested in writing, because in those days, with the French New Wave and the European influence, the new auteur idea was coming into being. People didn't understand what auteur meant. You know, you make it up on the spot, you improvise, you get on the set, you're the director's in charge, and that was the way it was. Screenwriting was looked down upon. It was like, oh, that, and they still is, by the way. People, you know, think, I don't know why, but for some reason, screenwriters are not as respected as they should be. And then I work with Robert Bolt. Robert Bolt gives me a burst of sunlight. I mean, he's one of the leading screenwriters of his time, and he works closely with me, edits, fine tunes my screenplay of The Cover Up, which never got made, and it turns out to be a Bolt Stone type script, mixed 50-50. I'm very proud of it. It's a good script, but Robert was. He made the mission. He wrote the mission, too. So sometimes, you know, it was downbeat, and people don't like those movies sometimes. So anyway, Robert was very astute. He taught me a lot about screenwriting, but I was still half and half, half screenwriter, half director. I wanted to direct. So let's say it wasn't working, and my marriage was a comfortable marriage. And I would have made a living, I imagine, because of my wife's connections to Europe. And we would have gotten by. But I had disappointed myself, because why had I gone to Vietnam in the first place? I'd taken a risk. Risk is important. You don't know what you're doing. You're young enough to take a risk, you know. That was the idea. And I, you know, I said, this is not working, and I got to go out there on my own. I got to be back in Los Angeles where Bolt was. I have to find my way. And I got to get out of New York, because it's not working for me. So it was very painful, but I had to end that marriage. And I came out to LA, and lo and behold, within a week or two, boom, things start to go well, because I'd written a script of Platoon, which had been ignored. Because of Robert Bolt, people got interested in it.
Yeah.
And read it. And Marty Bregman, of all people who I didn't know, called me. And as the book shows, says, hey, this Platoon's a great script. Let me option it. We'll make it with Al Pacino and so forth and so on, and Sidney Lumet. So that's how the carousel starts.
Yes. And we should say, you know, this is about 1976, 10 years before Platoon ever actually makes it to the screen. And there was a lot of heartbreak regarding both that project, which was originally The Platoon. And it was sort of, you know, these two polar opposite leaders of the platoon are actually people who had sort of inspired by different leaders that you dealt with in Vietnam.
People didn't understand that. People tell me, I didn't know those two. I thought those two sergeants were exaggerations. And, you know, yeah, they didn't. One of them didn't kill the other, but believe me, they might have under different circumstances. In that platoon were real people. That's why I was critic proof in that sense. Like, you can say to me, you know, Oliver Stone loves violence. Look at his films. Look at You're the Dragon, Midnight Express, Scarface. He loves mutilation above all, blah, blah, blah. I saw all this shit. That's not like I am. That's the world I grew up in. That violent. Yeah. And critics never let me off the hook on that one, you know. The only film that I ever did that was a violation of that was on purpose, was this Natural Born Killers was a satire on purpose. People didn't get that. Everything else tries to be as realistic as possible, unlike so many war films where you see too much. It's just too cinematic. It falls into an easy category. Actually, wars are very oddball, eccentric, and kind of dull, and very hard to film. And of course, you always need compromises with the screen, because let's say you have an enemy at 100 yards away, it's very dangerous. But in movies, they'll make them 50 yards or 40 yards away, because that's, you can see the fucking guy. You can't see him.
Yeah. And it's interesting, because here you are, fresh from being in Vietnam. You bring an authenticity to your writing about it that somebody just sitting around in Hollywood might not, would certainly not have. And yet the Vietnam movies that are getting made around that time, Coming Home, Deer Hunter, those get made. But your two, first The Platoon and then Born on the 4th of July, which had been kind of presented to you as a idea to follow, these for years couldn't get done. 10 years with Platoon, 11, I believe.
10 for both. 10 for both.
10 for both.
Yeah. Actually, Born on the 4th comes out in 89. It was finished in 79.
Yeah.
And Platoon 76 gets made in 86. It's a strange, as I said, there's these strange dates, January 1, 68, September 15. For me, they register, but they register. 10 years for both. I got sucked into the Born on the 4th of July. I learned a lot on that, because that was Bregman again. Marty Bregman pulled me back. He said, I have another project. This is after Platoon didn't work out. I have another project for you with Sidney and Al. It's Born on the 4th of July. This story, this terrific story about this kid, front page book review, Ron Kovic. He was paralyzed. So I hung out with Rob, and I learned a lot. I found out a lot about the vets. I didn't know much about the vets. I had lived in a city in New York without many vets, combat vets. In L.A., there were a hell of a lot more of them, and because they were around the veterans' hospitals, and I got to know that world. That opened my eyes to a lot of things, too.
Well, and it's incredible that you write that on the same day you first met Ron Kovic, you also met the guy who was the inspiration for Salvador.
That's correct. It was Richard Boyle, the Irish-American journalist. He was a character hanging around Ron. He'd written a book about a mutiny in Vietnam, Flower of the Dragon, which was I liked a lot. It was about when the U.S. Army was starting to fall apart over there. There was a morale factor that dipped very low. He caught the nature of that war. He knew. He was always for the underdog, Richard. But that's a great day when you can meet two guys that become the basis of two films.
Yeah. So the first real bang that came about out of the Platoon screenplay was actually Midnight Express, right? Because people were impressed by your writing abilities, but they weren't going to let you make that. And so along comes, I guess it was Peter Guber initially with Midnight Express, and you have great success with that. Ultimately, it goes on and wins you win the Best Adapted Screenplay Oscar. You're just 33. You've been in LA only 2 years. It's an amazing thing. But at the same time, you write about dealing with all kinds of other things that, you know, you describe it as the downfall, not long after winning the Oscar. So what was it like to be, you know, essentially become the highest paid screenwriter, the hottest screenwriter in town by the time of Scarface in 83, or when that came out in 83, but you're still a frustrated guy because you're not getting to direct a fully realized vision of your own.
That's absolutely correct. I wouldn't say the highest paid because it might have been higher, but I certainly was one of the hottest. And
yes,
I was also known as a rebel back then, mm-hmm. and a standard of rebelliousness was a standard that had been kind of, wow, if Oliver Stone can get away with that, we can get away with it. I was known as a guy who would try to get his own way, which is to say screenwriters are really bullied. They are at the bottom of this fucking jungle. I mean, they are the edible ones. The ones that the insects eat. Everybody eats you, believe me. And the more I got into that mess, then as a director, of course, I saw the other side of it. I mean, they go through, if you have big money in a studio, they go through writers like subways, turnstiles, you know. It's not a big deal. I mean, and at times I've been said, well, let's get another writer, but I never felt too much into that. But really, a writer is an anonymous wretch, ink-stained wretch. You know, I hate the thought of it because I really admire screenwriters, and the good ones are rare. Good ones are rare. But you don't have to be a great one. You just have to be a good one. Yeah. Once put it together, it's just an architectural blueprint. At first, I was making my sentences flowery. I was trying to say, you know, this is, I was calling attention to the writing. Well, how the hell are they going to film the writing? It's not that easy. If you write in too much metaphor, it doesn't work. I did that quite a bit, but I my Conan script, you should see it. It reads like a novel. But I will tell you something that was bothering the shit out of me, and you mentioned those films. I mean, Apocalypse Now and Deer Hunter were amazingly good films. They're very powerful, but completely unrealistic to my mind. Mm-hmm. So that bothered me. And then when Stallone hit with Coming Home was a good film, but made no money. So that was hardly, it was hardly helpful to my cause. But when Stallone came along with this Rambo, the first one wasn't bad. It was good. The second one, and the one where he goes back to Vietnam to get all the POWs, and the Chuck Norris nonsense with the missing adventure. They made a fortune. Don't laugh about it. They were really the paradigm. They were, come on, we got to make, can you write a film like that? You have to understand that at this point I was really down on that. I just couldn't do it. I was sickened because of Ron Kovic's position, essentially, was really no more Vietnams. And then the climate changed in the 80s, unfortunately, with Reagan. Yeah. All of a sudden, it was okay to go think about Vietnam as a just war, as a victorious war, which we really didn't lose, but we had our hands tied behind our backs politically by the system. And we still have to go back, and we have to get all our missing POWs. It didn't matter that we killed 3 to 4 million Vietnamese, Cambodians, and Laotians. It didn't matter. What mattered was a few missing POWs, you see. Why is that American life worth more than any other life? It's something that has mystified me for 60 years now.
Now, do you think when you were having these thoughts and these years of kind of ups and downs before you got to really direct the films that were truly yours, do you think that you had PTSD? Has that ever been totally established?
I'm sure I had it, you know, but they didn't. It was like I came too early for most of these things. Like when I was an adolescent, there was no acknowledgement that adolescents had problems.
Mm-hmm.
And adolescent suicide happened all the time, but no acknowledgement of it. Right. So my run to Vietnam was a form of suicide. But lo and behold, God intended me to live. Also, at that time, PTSD was unknown. It wasn't called that. Shell shock might have been the word. I don't even know what it was. But whatever it was everyone had it to a degree because we came back to a society that was so different. Nobody was fighting the war except a few nutcases in Washington, you see. That was really what it was about. The people really didn't care. except unless they had a son there or a daughter or, right. You know, something at stake.
So the book is your newest book is dedicated to John Daly. And for people who may not know, can you just share a bit about who he was and how he ended up being so pivotal to the making of both of these films of yours that you directed in 1986, this one of the most incredible years for a director ever, to have first Salvador come out and then Platoon? Just how did John Daly, why does he earn the dedication?
Well, it's a magic year, as you can see. Nothing doesn't happen. It doesn't. I mean, honestly, I was just learning the ropes to direct. I was, Platoon is very much a young filmmaker film. It's not like super sophisticated because we had very little money. Very little. We had $6 million at the end of the day for a 54-day shoot in jungle. And Salvador was even tighter. John gave us, that one, I don't know the actual final budget. It could have climbed up to $4 to $5 million, but it was always in increments, you know, 100,000 here, 100,000. It was a struggle to get this. Maybe we had 93 speaking parts. It was two countries, Mexico and the U.S. It had battles, death squads, civilian massacres. Wow, we had so much story in that. It was like Boyle's ragtag mind let loose, you know, and I wanted to film everything. It was the most difficult film I've ever made with Salvador in terms of never knowing what's going to happen, who's going to show up the next day, the crew, the cast, the money, the sicknesses, the difficulty of shooting in jungle and also in cities. I learned a lot on the film with Bob Richardson, who was my cameraman, and with Bruno Rubeo, who was my production designer, and Alex Ho, who was my line producer. But who is John Daly? He gets so little credit in the industry. I never hear his name, and it's a shame because I know you hear about Harvey Weinstein starting the whole indie movement. As far as I know, the indie movement started before Harvey Weinstein. It started in the early 80s when video came along and it made possible the idea of making these films for less money. For example, when Platoon at one point belonged to Dino De Laurentiis, who was avaricious in his appetite, and I had to sue him to get my script back after he couldn't make it. I had to sue him. That was a very down moment for me. I'm suing a guy who's used to 50 lawsuits a year, you know. And I won. I won the lawsuit. I got my script back. Who knew that it would become something? But the point was that Daly started in England in this, and he'd been a boxing promoter, among other things, in his life, a pub owner, I believe. And you do a little homework on him. I don't know his background that well, but I know Ali Foreman fight in the jungle he was in on the deal, and I know he got some prison time in the Congo. He was a guy from the East End. I loved him because he was down to earth and funny as hell, like all Cockneys can be, you know, have a jaundiced view of the world, but had a generous heart like Boyle. He loved the underdogs. So there was basically John, and he was generous. He felt my passion. He said this in an interview. He felt the passion and dedication I had. And that's what he was looking for in his filmmakers for less than a buck to make good movies. That was his. And he made a few in his time. He made The Hoosiers with Gene Hackman, which I loved. He made, after Platoon, he made Salvador, he made Platoon. Then he made The Last Emperor, which is amazing film, one of the executive producer of. He won an Oscar on that, too. Won two in a row. And he made other films, too, some less distinguished than others. But he was making films, trying with young people at a price. I suppose the problem with John is that, as with anybody, there's always flaws, right? He was cute. He was clever. I mean, he was always, you know, like a Robin Hood. He was trying to rip off the system, too. So I know that in the case of Platoon, because he got sued by Arnold Copelson, the producer, the other producer, he sold Platoon to two different companies for the video rights. You know, there was a lot of gamesmanship with John because he was dealing with an international banking deal out of Holland, the Crédit Lyonnais, with a French company. And I never knew where the money was, ever. Gerald Green was involved. You should also look him up. He was another scoundrel. I love him. Alec Guinness type. he ran the Mexico operation, and he was another guy. He was busted eventually for bribing Thailand Thai festival officials. But Gerald was a guy you'd love to be in a prison cell with, believe me. He had the greatest worried look on his face I've ever seen, and it's a classic. I loved him, and Gerald and John and Arnold Copelson, too, produced the movie. But John was the heart and soul and was the money. And at the end of the day, as I showed in so many incidents that, you know, when I was down on my luck, he would say, don't worry, you know, we are going to get this made. I mean, believe in me. We're never going to let you go, Oliver. We're not going to. This film will be, Salvador will be finished.
Well, and I guess another key early ally would have been Paula Wagner at CAA. Let's just note, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, she kind of helped with the packaging of some of these movies so that other CAA clients wound up a part of it. You've got James Woods for Salvador, Tom Berenger and Willem Dafoe for Platoon, Michael Douglas for Wall Street, Tom Cruise for Born on the 4th of July, Val Kilmer for The Doors, and maybe others as well. But yeah, if you wanted to just say anything about that.
Sure. I mean, Paula was fundamental, as was Mike Menchel at the same agency. They brought me to CAA, which I hadn't known about. There was a new company, and brought me in there. I had originally been with William Morris, and Ron Mardigian had did a, who was helped me a lot, represented me in the as a writer, but he wasn't as a director. Paula was more into directors and could provide the actors, so I moved over there after being with Jeff Berg in the middle. Paula was in the business with me for many years until, and Val was one of her clients, Tom, all that, until she left. Unfortunately, she left to go with Tom Cruise on his business deal. So that was the end of that.
Yeah. So when the Oscars in 1987, recognizing the films of 86 happened, and you're there nominated against yourself for screenplay with Salvador and Platoon, and then nominated for director for Platoon, your film's nominated for Best Picture. You were 40 years old, which was maybe a bit older than when most directors really become stars, in a sense. And you chose to end your book on that Oscar, to do with that Oscar night. And I think you've described it as that was because that was really the realization of the dream. You said, quote, I got to make the movie I wanted to make, close quote. Can you just talk about what it meant to get to the top of the mountain, and then what pressure comes with that?
Well, you've asked two different questions, but I think to understand what it means to get to the top of the mountain, you have to go through the journey of, you didn't mention The Hand, but certainly that plays a huge role here, because The Hand was my first studio directed effort. And on that film, which I, by the way, looked at recently, and I still like it. It's a psychological, it's a very interesting psychological movie. With a sterling performance by Michael Caine as a man going mad, who's very jealous of his wife and his young wife who's leaving him. So it's based on that, a good book, a psychological book by Mark Brandel. The problem was, as a young director, I didn't have full control of the movie, and I talk about how it's taken away from you, and how they erode you by putting a stronger producer on. That's one of the first things they do. They weren't happy with Ed Pressman, so who I liked, and they put John Peters on, and that was a rocky ride for me. And then they put an editor on who I could not stand, who was doing this as a job to get from the East Coast Union into the West Coast Union. I was just a gas station on his way, and they put a composer with me who, all these people were talented, but they just didn't, I couldn't work with them. And so as a result, you know, the movie, I was always under pressure to make that movie, unnecessary pressure on myself too. So I ended up, I feel like a bit of like a traffic cop trying to make all the temperaments emerge and keeping things calm and on schedule. We did a pretty good job of that, but it took its toll on me and my nerves. But I think when I saw the movie the other day, I just, wow, I said, well, I forgot The Hand is pretty well done. I mean, this Carlo Rambaldi, we at the end of the day, he did deliver a very interesting mechanical hand that did a lot of crazy stuff. And Michael Caine, in the final scene, fighting with his hand in the garage, is as insane a concept as you can get, as a man fighting with himself, you know. And the hand is a hallucinatory, but it doesn't look like it is in that film, in that scene, you know. So I think the ending is clever, of course, with poking the eye of the audience. However, you know, what was it? Fish or fowl? That was the problem. John Peters was after me. Is it a horror film or you're making a psychological thriller? I was making a thriller. That's what I wanted to make. And I made the mistake of tightening it, the hand. So when you call something the hand, you got to make it into a horror film. And it wasn't a horror film. And I got killed for it. Shamed in a way I shouldn't have been, but I allowed myself to be. I wasn't strong enough to resist that. Oh, it's my fault, mea culpa. You say, I'm embarrassed. I think when you have a failure, you think the whole world's seen it at the same time as you are. So,
not so. Yeah.
And I started to get really depressed and doing cocaine and all that stuff, you know, to try to drive it away.
And so I see why you went back to the hand before addressing, you know, that being on the top of the mountain, because you appreciate it all the more, I think, probably when you've been through struggles like that.
Recognizing Hollywood failure is as important as recognizing Hollywood success and knowing what they mean. And I certainly learned the lessons of both. When people don't look at you, when you come into a restaurant and people look at you, you know, you can tell the silence and all that.
Right.
I lived through both forms of that, shame and success. So you got to have a little bit of a, you know, you learn to what failure means, which is, it's a tremendous amount of self-abnegation, but it ends up with you having to accept it for what it is and rededicating yourself.
Right.
It's learning not to seek revenge or getting even. It's not about that. It's about learning as much as you can from failure and realizing there's so much difference between the two. Sometimes a film for a marginal reason can succeed, whereas for the same marginal reason, it can fail. I just want to go back to your question, which was...
Sure.
Give it to me again about that night.
Well, so what's it like being on the top of the mountain, and why end the story at that point, the book at that point?
Because I'd been through so many downfalls, so many disappointments by that time. And I trace them back to the divorce. I say, you know, I go through all the shit and the hopes I had, the cover up with Bolt, the rejection of my screenplays, so many screenplays, you know, each one meant something to me. The failure of my divorce, of my marriage, rather. All this piles up. So here, you know, you don't know how long you're going to live, but all of a sudden you make a movie that the world falls over and instantaneously. It's like you can't know what that's like unless everyone knows about it. So somehow it gets around faster. And as I said, I tried to make the analogy of once you show it in some small screening room somewhere, word gets out.
And absolutely.
That was what happened with Platoon. So, you know, then after all this success and failure, mostly failure, Platoon becomes the international grossing. Every country grosses big, every country, and which shows you there is an international market. And for nothing, we made it. John Daly and Arnold Copelson made some good money on that. Certainly John, if he hadn't been sued by, would have made more money, but he certainly did well. And he used it, however he used it. But John made that movie happen, for Christ's sake. So there was no distribution on Salvador. That's one thing you never got into. I'd say, we made that movie without distribution, without Hemdale was distributing it. That was a nothing company. They hired one guy, Peter Myers, and he basically did it from all his contacts and relationships. But there was nobody on Salvador except... And then reluctantly on Platoon, Orion got in reluctantly, as I tried to point out. So when you say the top of the mountain, it was no easy top of the mountain. You see, I was so down after Salvador, the hand, and I have to include Scarface too, because that ended badly for me with my fighting with my mentor, Marty Bregman, who I respected and who was very good with screenplay, actually. Marty had was like a control freak beyond belief. And I got into the middle of it with his wife, Al Pacino. I mean, Al and him had been fighting way before I came into the story. And I got in the middle of that one.
Yeah.
Which you never want to do when they're, because they used to hate each other. They would drive each other nuts. And then so I pulled away. I mean, they cut me out. I was blackballed by Marty, and he had power. So that I was really down in the dumps again. And I fought my way back with Salvador, which was like nobody wanted to make the movie. It's like throwing a grappling hook onto a ledge above you and hoping that it holds. I had no fucking place to go. I go to Salvador, just to keep in mind, with Richard Boyle, who's got no money. I'm paying for everything. And I don't have that much coming. I mean, I have a mortgage. I have stuff like that. I got a new wife. I got a baby. I got a mother I'm supporting. It's crazy.
Yeah.
And I want to make this movie about a revolution in Central America. It's not an easy one. So we go down there, and Rich is telling me, we're going to get help from the Salvadoran government. You'll see. They're going to give us 50 grand. Just for the helicopters alone, they're going to give us of that free. So we're going to make Apocalypse Now down there. You'll see what happens. And sure enough, he takes me through the military hierarchy. Very interesting. And all the right-wing groups there. And the government's in cahoots with the death squads to some degree. And the U.S. is supporting it. They want to kill off all the reformers. We meet them, too. And we're in the middle of this bloodbath. And we're telling them lies about the script. Because our plan, of course, is to go after the movie we shoot in Salvador. We're going to go to Mexico and show the rebel as the good guys in Mexico. So it was a con that was bound to fail. It would never work. But I was so desperate that I believed it.
Yeah. Oh, it's amazing.
It just goes to show you where I'm just saying it was a two-shot leap to the top.
Yeah.
Salvador works out barely. By the skin of its teeth, it works out because I think that the climate changed on Central America when Reagan got busted on the Contra-Iran deal. He was Reagan was shipping money and arms to the Contras,
yes,
who were an illegal terrorist organization operating out of Nicaragua with our support. So after that, the climate changed, and that's right when Platoon came out. So Platoon, in a way, their bookends. Platoon is about another war and another era. And Salvador is about a war that's going on practically now, which the U.S. again is abetting and supporting.
Interesting.
It was as good a time as any to come out with those two films. I don't know if it came out today's world. I'm not sure that it would be accepted because we're so super patriotic now.
Yeah. Well, so the book again ends on Oscar night. I imagine and hope there will be a sequel one day. But in the meantime, I'd love to so I don't get crucified by listeners. They have a lot of favorites that are not covered in the book of favorites of yours. Maybe just some highlights if I can.
Can I just read something first?
Please.
I'd been chasing the light a long time now. I'd felt its power. I was now 40 years old, proverbially at the halfway point. It'd been a remarkable two-film journey from the bottom back to the top of the Hollywood mountain. With Salvador, I'd slung the stone hard and far, and it had given me a foothold. And with Platoon, I'd managed to crest into the light. Money, fame, glory, and honor. It was all there at the same time and space. I had to move now. I'd been waiting too many years to make films. Time had wings. I wanted to make one after the other, in a race against that time. I suppose really a race against myself, in a hall of mirrors of my own making.
That's beautiful.
Those films, that's another story. It's like the dream is realized, really realized. And it's important, so important to have that feeling. And I value it. I valued it at the time even more so now, because it's a feeling that you know is in a way has to last you a lifetime. It's very rare that you get to be a hero at one point in your life.
Yeah.
I'm hardly that now. I'm a flawed human being to many people. But that's the nature of the journey, isn't it? So after that came a succession. I mean, in a sense, I did want to learn filmmaking. I was relatively still inexperienced. And I learned quickly on Wall Street was a much bigger film because it was done with a studio. It's my first experience working directly with a studio, and it was a mixed one.
And that came out just a year later. You're back with Charlie Sheen. You're in the universe now in which your father had sort of existed for his whole life, doing the kind of movie that he probably most wanted you to do. And it was so interesting because the way you described it at one point, quote, Wall Street is an extension of combat. Taking over a company is like a military action. In these raids, they stay up for weeks on end on an adrenaline high, and a lot of their terminology is war terminology, close quote. So it's not just some random coincidence, perhaps, that you made that movie with your background. Maybe it was subconscious even, right, that would be something you're drawn to.
Well, in the Hollywood landscape, if you look at the time, there was very few business movies ever made. My father used to say, you know, they don't make stories about business that are realistic, sort of like what I'd been saying about warfare and Platoon. I loved the Walter Huston movie that Frank Capra did at the edge of the Depression there. I also loved Executive Suite by Robert Wise. But there's very few. And I said, this is a – why? Because America – the business of America is business, is what Calvin Coolidge said. There's truth to that. Wall Street, little did I know, was at the center of it. I mean, my father had always talked about it, but he talked about the good side. And it was a different time. He represented modesty. Money was never boasted about. If you were rich, you would never talk about it like Donald Trump talks about it. It's vulgar. Right. But there was a lot of that going on. It was a new world. And above all, young people were starting to make big bucks. Never happened before. You see, young people worked their way up. But all of a sudden, guys who were 29 years old were making millions of dollars. It was like cocaine. It was a wacko. Things got off base. And I contrasted my father's world to this world.
Yeah.
When the character of Charlie Sheen, I guess the character of Hal Holbrook to some degree represents my dad.
And I guess, you know, in the 23 years between when that film came out and when you did its sequel, a whole generation of people who would have imagined, I guess, that Greed is Good would have actually inspired all of these people to go to Wall Street.
Yeah. I would say Hal Holbrook and Martin Sheen, I left him out.
Sure.
Based on my father's honesty. Yeah, but what happened after that is completely, it's wrong what happened. I mean, it was a morality tale. It was Charlie realized that Gecko was no good and that it was a pilgrim's progress. He'd fallen and he realized it, and he was going to take responsibility for his mistake. And that was too moral for people at the time. I remember the critics were not great on it. And it was like, you know, that I was moralizing. Well, that was the story I wanted to tell. So
right.
It was a bit like Platoon come back, but a form of domestic warfare.
Yeah.
Where he survives, Charlie Sheen survives, but he becomes also a murderer in a way. He sold his father out. It was a good film. I enjoyed it very much.
Very.
I wanted to make Sweet Smell of Success, and we modeled it on, you know, a lot of quips, a lot of one-liners, and we had fun doing it.
Only Michael Douglas's performance really was the only thing that the Academy paid attention to. But so then, though, 2 years later, was Born on the 4th of July when it came out. I think still the best thing Tom Cruise has ever done. You win Best Director again, second time in, what is that, like 4 years? That's not many people can ever say that. And I guess for you, the most important thing, even just watching your Oscar acceptance speech today, just to go back and refresh on it, it seems like the first thing from during the making of it and right through Oscar night was doing right by Ron Kovic.
Yeah, there was a lot of that too.
For you, though, Ron had been the guy that you were able to talk to about the war for the first, in a certain way, for the first time, right?
Ron had brought me into his circle in Los Angeles of many vets, and I saw the passion that Ron had against the war. And I would say, you know, he too had a case of friendly fire, and he makes it very clear in the book. Friendly fire, as I talked about in one chapter, was a major player in Vietnam, and we ignore it. The Pentagon ignores it. Movies ignore it. It plays a huge role. And it's sad that so many of the things that you see in the war, I put in the book, they don't pay attention to it, Lee. They don't pay attention to those facts. But if 20%, I think 20% of the casualties in any war are basically from friendly fire, you have to count that up.
Yeah.
You see how many problems that raises with the parents and all that. And
terrible.
You're neglected, of course. I know we're going fast, but there is a film I did in between in which I learned a great deal was Talk Radio, which I think is one of my better films in a way.
Yeah.
It's really got a lot of technique to it, and I learned a lot working in the studio.
Absolutely. Well, 91 is another, it's a year like 86 for you. Just insane to have both The Doors come out in March and then JFK come out in December. With The Doors, it seems like the appeal to you, this was music that really struck you when you were in Vietnam, as you write about in your book, but also this was a guy who in some ways, it seems like his course was the opposite. His father, I think, had been a military man, and he ran in the other direction, whereas you had the inverse, right?
Jim was a more fully realized person than I was at that point. He was a poet. He was far more emotionally intelligent than I was. I was finding my way.
Mm-hmm.
He was the soul of a poet, a very sensitive man. I can see the destructiveness in him too, and he wrote about it. But I really admired him, and I'm glad I brought some light onto him, and it really revitalized The Doors' career again. The record sales, everything picked up, surged.
Well, with JFK, just to remind people, you're with Costner coming off of Dances with Wolves. You've got this unbelievable supporting cast of Pesci, Matthau, Asner, Lemon, Sutherland, goes on and on. And I think people, you know, the focus was heavily on, in terms of the media coverage, was about the debate over the subject matter. But I mean, it's a beautifully made movie. If people go back and look at the Mr. X monologue and then the montage around that, and just all of that was great. But I guess I want to ask you, has it bothered you that in the years since, from the coverage, even before the movie was out, you know, that there are some people that just can't hear the name Oliver Stone without thinking, you know, conspiracy nut or whatever those things are? Or can you just kind of brush that off?
It's not that easy to brush off. It happens all the time. Politics overshadows the filmmaking. I realize that, but what am I going to do? My opinions, when asked, are given.
Yeah.
Sometimes I try to be political about it and diplomatic, but I'm not a liar.
Yeah.
And I can't go along with what the vast majority believe on so much of this history stuff. And I actually did my own. I did a lot of research, and I worked with a historian, Peter Kuznick, on Untold History of the United States.
Yes.
I gave up 5 years. That was a nonprofit deal. 5 years working on that thing. And mainstream held its nose up at it. They didn't even bother to review it. But progressive historians have reviewed us remarkably well. But that's a series that people have discovered on Netflix now. Thank God they finally discovered it. It's gone very well as a sale for Netflix. But it should be mainstream. It should be in schools. That's not going to happen with the school system that we have and the way the politics buys the books. What books do kids read? There's a whole thing about American history.
Well, with just quick follow up on that, though, I mean, here we are. Next year is going to be 30 years since JFK. Hard to believe, but I guess, you know, the film led to, I think, some more information coming out. I just wonder, in your mind, do we today have a better, or do you today have a better idea of who killed JFK or why? What's your current theory?
I do. And you have to see the 4 hours to understand, because otherwise it would be sensationalistic. We give a lot of detail because the Assassination Records Review Board was a legitimate reviewing body. They went back into the records. They asked for the records. They didn't get cooperation from either the CIA or from the Secret Service, I mean, who destroyed their records. There was just a lot of resistance all the way. Despite that, there is some good work that was done. And we have dug that up. No one in the media paid attention. We've dug that up and we're putting it all under one binder, one thing that the audience can understand. So we talk about various things, from what Kennedy was trying to do to what happened to him and how, and we go through the autopsy again, which is unbelievable. We go through the chain of custody of all the evidence and how we see that there is no evidence. There's nothing at all that stands up. Nothing at all that stands up. And that's hard for people to understand. It was baked testimony. It was completely false, the stuff that they put out there to pin it on him. Anyway, it's all in there. It takes time and thinking. It's not going to be a...
You're talking about in the original JFK film.
I'm talking about in reality.
No, I know. But where, and if somebody wants to know your current, what you've learned from the 30 years since.
Well, I learned it then because the evidence doesn't get old. What's wrong with the original evidence?
No. Sure,
as Mark Lane said, that it's always been covered up. That whole Warren Commission thing was a sham. Appointing Alan Dulles, head of the CIA, he fired him as one of the commissioners is a disgrace. But that's America back in those days. You could get away with that. They couldn't get away with that now, because there'd be too many cell phones on the day. But we did have cell phones there, and what that reveals is enough.
What the counter argument I've heard, I was at Brandeis University, and there was a class on conspiracy. I think it is fascinating stuff. I want to ask you though. The counter argument is, how could somebody keep a secret, right?
I've heard that so much. It's just, I mean, you can go back. I guess we can make a list of about 100 plus people who have said something,
who talked,
who know something and have said, this happened to me, blah, blah, blah. We don't pay attention, but nobody knows the whole thing. No one was on the inside. If there was a small body of people who agreed to do this, and those people are dead. I mean, for them, I mean, it would be their lifetime. You think Alan Dulles would talk about it with any? He lied all his life. You should see his interviews. Fabulous. I mean, the guy is the biggest, most charming liar of all. If you're a piece of a puzzle, no one knows. Then I did this and I saw that day. That's not enough. You don't get the whole. The whole is pretty well. No one who was actually an assassin or an executioner, somebody who was a shooter, would even know, unless he pulled the trigger, what he was doing there that day. You could have been told, as far as you're a military guy, you're there for security. But someone in your unit, someone, you don't even know who, because you don't know the names, somebody pulled the trigger. Maybe more than one, obviously. But you had to have at least two shooters. And Oswald was not one of them.
Briefly, I think people don't know, and I know you would like them to know, that your Vietnam films, there was a trilogy, and the third was excellent as well, Heaven and Earth in 93, which was also the same year that you were an executive producer of the last Hollywood film with an all-Asian cast until Crazy Rich Asians 25 years later, The Joy Luck Club. So just if you want to talk about these kind of untold stories from the perspective of Asian members of the Asian community, if you just have anything to say about that before we go any further.
Oh, I was passionate about Heaven and Earth. It's a beautiful story. Lely Hayslip wrote it. My story would be first, then Ron Kovic's, which is a larger American story about him coming home to an America that as a cripple. It gave me much more breadth and depth. His story followed. And then the third one had to be about a Vietnamese woman. And I didn't set out to do it, but it fell that way because this woman sent me the book. I loved the book. Her story was very moving to me. And that film still breaks my heart with Tommy Lee Jones, who was great. And it's about the ups and downs of a life. She became an American war bride. She was on both sides of the war. She ends up in America. It's about family and about keeping something sacred in the family, despite all the tragedy that happens in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
Great story, by the way. I can have a film festival of under-attended films, including Talk Radio, Heaven and Earth. There's quite a few that I have in my life.
Sure. Back with Tommy Lee Jones a year later with Natural Born Killers, which I understand, you feel is a very misunderstood film in the sense that First of all, we should just note that from a craft point of view, it's almost in the best sense like an experimental film with all these different film stocks and colors and editing and all of that. But for you, people kind of miss the joke in a way, right? This was meant to send up the violence of our society, right?
Yeah, I don't know what to do about this. It seems like it's a constant thing. It's politics overshadows misunderstanding. It's the only film I'd said it's a satire. I guess whatever I say, I just can't open my mouth. That's what scares me about the media. What do I say? After a certain point, you can't make a film. There's too much baggage comes before it.
Well, and that was the case, I guess, with both Nixon in 95 and W in 2008, where your people have seen JFK, they think a certain thing about you. And meanwhile, when they actually see the movie, people said that they were very surprised that, particularly with W, it was actually a fairly empathetic portrait of, it doesn't mean you love the guys, Nixon or W, but it was.
I made the point that I was a dramatist. A dramatist walks in the shoes of the protagonist, which means you don't necessarily agree with him. I didn't agree with anything George Bush did. I think he was one of the worst president we ever had, next to his great-grandfather, Franklin Pierce.
More than Trump?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
In terms of damage, we still have all this shit he left behind. Patriot Act, the Middle East. He was of course led by his people, but he was a typical Yale dropout. he was in my class there, but
yeah,
he was the C student. I was saying that in both those cases, it's sad because I love Nixon is another kind of film completely. But again, I'm a dramatist. Nixon is another one. I never liked his line about Vietnam and all the other stuff. But he was an interesting figure, much deeper than George Bush. And again, as a dramatist, it's my job to try to get inside the skin. But people, if you do something like get inside somebody, they think you automatically are that person. So often critics confuse that. They thought I was Richard Boyle after Salvador, and it's true. And they confuse empathy with so-called sympathy. I say that because the same thing happens in the Putin interviews to some degree, because here's a man, most important leader, one of the most important leaders of this century, has a lot to do with where the world is going. And they don't want to listen. They don't want to listen. They think it's all pablum. You think he talked for five different visits over 2.5 years? Pablum? No. He's talking because he trusts that it will get across in his native language. And I didn't dub him like most American televisions do, put a thug's voice in for him. I left his own voice.
But when people just to play devil's advocate, though, about that, I mean, they see that you've made some very interesting documentaries, but they've tended to they've been about Castro, Chavez a couple times, Putin, and then some of the press around those, where like with Putin, I don't know if you were misunderstood, but the sense that people got from some of the press around that documentary was that you don't believe that he actually interfered in the 2016 election. So I think they come in wondering what your agenda is.
Jesus Christ. Do you think everybody in the country has to believe this Russian election stuff? Do you think we all have to agree? Does anybody have any ability to dissent from an opinion? Is it a fact that happened? I mean, if you talk to anybody in a lot of the intelligent people in the cyber community, and I have because I did a film about Edward Snowden,
yes,
will tell you that it was not a hack. It was a steal. It was inside job. And Julian Assange has been good on his word ever since he started. He's been an authentic person. I admire him deeply. To say that he was in collusion with the Russians and all this is part of some kind of crazy fiction that has happened to this country. You probably believe it. You have no choice but to believe it.
No, well, I mean, I understand what you're saying, but I guess for most Americans, all we can go on is if they say that uniformly the American intelligence community believes that Putin interfered in the election.
Uniformly, no. The original statement was a high degree of confidence or something like that, and it was taken from three agencies, not from the 17 that they claim. In fact, you could go back into the intelligence community and you will find dissenters if they're honest. It's really, this has been misrepresented. I've talked to a lot of experts on this and what was required at the time. Well, we don't want to get back into that debate, but FBI did not do its job. It should have gotten the original system that released, it got back into the computer, the DNC computer, but they didn't give it. They gave it to a private company, CrowdStrike, that was on their payroll. So the whole thing is crooked from the inside. It feels like the JFK case again. But it wasn't planned. It was developed that way. But it certainly was developed from inside. Sore losers, I would call it. And by the way, I don't have any. Trump has done things that are horrifying to me. So I'm trying to be impartial, and I'm trying to stay outside and be what you call a dramatist in this case, and try to understand both sides, try to understand the mind of Julian Assange, the mind of whoever hacked the DNC. What did he hack and what was on his mind? Maybe it bothered him that the Democratic Party was selling out the way it did. Maybe it bothered them that Hillary Clinton's Wall Street speeches or the DNC's undermining of Bernie Sanders. Maybe it bothered him, and maybe he did take things out to give them to Assange, which is what a lot of people say happened. But that story has been, quote, discredited. I don't know why. Because it doesn't fit in a present agenda for a Cold War against Russia, which is basically for more money for the military, when we spend it a fortune already. And now it's for China, too. It's, you're going to regret this kind of thinking. This kind of thinking leads to conventional war. The war, Cold War grows and grows and grows, and then we take it to the edge. And because we have to, because we're Americans, and we're top of the world. We think we're top of the world. We're going to take things to a place where very dangerous for our people. That's why I'm dissenting from this.
Got it.
I hope you understand, and it's important we have dissenters.
Well, I appreciate the conversation, and I guess with the last minute, because I'm gonna get out of your way in 1 minute here. The last thing is just what we call a rapid fire. Just the first word or two that come to your mind, if you don't mind. First of all, have you seen Spike Lee's Vietnam movie, The Five Bloods, which is now on Netflix?
Yes, and I enjoyed it.
You did, okay. Because I know that I've seen the photos of you in service. You had some black members of your platoon, and I enjoyed
that part of it. I mean, frankly, it was very honest in the sense of five brothers getting down and talking. I mean, I never, for me, it was important. And what they did, they were connecting in ways that were deep. And it was a very interesting movie, not all successful, but it was very interesting.
Yeah. If you were somehow able to magically go back in time to that moment when you signed up for Vietnam, knowing what you know now, would you do it again?
It's not an answerable question because there's no if. I mean, I'm not. I mean, what I know now, of course, is much different. I mean, you can't. What are you saying? How are you going to live your life? You think there was a little twist in the road? Oh, if I'd done that, yeah, you can dream on that. But the truth is, we all face those decisions, and we make wrong ones all the time. Even if it was a wrong one, I did benefit. I made myself benefit from it. I turned it around. By the way, I just have to, the original question, we got into that whole Putin business because you asked me about being misunderstood. But I want to say one more thing about that. Even the film I did that made money, and quite a bit of money, was misunderstood. It was World Trade Center.
Yeah.
If you remember, I put my soul into that movie. I really cared. And at the movie came out, and it had some very fine reviews, and it made money, and worldwide, too. I thought a very powerful film, mm-hmm. and it was very spiritual for me. But the headline was basically, the negative headline was essentially, Oliver Stone becomes patriot, which is about politics, you know, or Oliver Stone fights for whatever, backs America, as if I was backing the Iraq War, which came out in 2000. The Iraq War in 2003 came out. That sounds like a movie, which started in 2003. You understand? I mean, it was about me backing Bush in a crazy way, but it wasn't that at all. It was about living in that fucking tower in those 24 hours. It was giving significance to the event as what it was for the guys who lived inside it, who lived through it.
Yeah.
Amazing story. And those people were real. And it was very authentic, and that's very authentic. We used real rescuers, all that. So I end up making a film which is, you know, appreciates the rescuers and the so-called patriots. And what do they say? They say negatively. There's a line at the end of the film. The guy, Michael Shannon plays, who rescues them, says, there's going to be payback for this, you know. And then he goes, something about he goes to Iraq, right? He goes to the Iraq War. Mm-hmm. They tie that to mean saying that, oh, that Stone is promoting the Iraq War, which was against my heart, against my soul.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, you understand, it just, it doesn't end. I mean, no matter what you do, there's
constant misunderstanding.
There's some tail to the situation that you never thought of.
Well, even I know Alexander, which we didn't mention, 2004, that's a movie that was not especially well received. But you've said, and I thought it was really interesting, that as with JFK, as with, I think, Nixon, you wish there had been an intermission because people might have seen the film differently if they had more, if it had the opportunity to breathe and even be longer. Your cut would have been longer, right?
Oh, it is. I have a cut out, 2014, which is called The Ultimate Alexander, The Ultimate, not Final Cut.
Yeah,
that is the best version I have put out there. It's about 95% of what I wanted to do. And it works. And there's been reviewed very nicely in the DVD reviews and stuff like that. Yeah. Very nicely indeed. It really does work. I knew I could make it work. I think one of the problems was I never cut. I had to live under 3 hours with Warner Brothers. I couldn't do it.
Yeah,
it was never that way. And it should have been a 3-hour-and-a-half film. Which it was.
And I know you say that was after there was a time at Warner Brothers with Semmel and Daly when you would have had more trust.
Yeah, when I did JFK, I went over for the first time, 3 hours. And so, but they understood.
Right.
They did understand, Terry and Bob, thank God. But the new regime, Jeff Robanoff and Alan Horn. Alan had his double, the devil conscience there with it. It was crazy, but they were very most worried about violence. Violence, sex was even wilder. I mean, the sex with a eunuch, I mean, you understand, with a eunuch, I mean, that's pretty wild for America, much less the homosexuality, much less in a warrior setting. I mean, never been done. But listen, I mean, it was a chokehold. I mean, it was a narrow, I tried to make them happy and I failed. And I made a mistake. I should have released, because we had French partners too, I should have released the original version, this 3-hour-and-a-half version in Europe in two parts, and then given them the film and said, cut what you want, do it your American style. And they would have cut it. They would have put their Warner's editor on it and not butchered it. They made a great film, but it wouldn't have been the same resonance that I had in it. That's one thing I should have done. I would have had to fight the studio at that point.
And this was World Trade Center again made money, but here was one where it would have been a tough fight. Okay, last two. First, you obviously pay very close attention to your country, to the news, to history. What would you say is the responsible decision for people when they go to the voting booth in November this year?
It's up to them. It's a, you know, everyone's got to come. I'm not going to jump into that one.
But I know you don't like Trump, you've said, but do you?
Well, Biden has his problems too, you know, but listen, I don't have to give you my
advice. No, you don't. Absolutely. Okay. Finally, you recently said in a New York Times profile that it was time to the release of this book, quote, Hollywood now, you can't make a film without a COVID advisor. You can't make a film without a sensitivity counselor. It's ridiculous, close quote. So I guess I just wonder, looking forward, obviously I hope there'll be another book, but will there be another Oliver Stone studio feature film, or are you saying the hell with it, it's not worth the fight anymore, I'm retired? What's your outlook looking forward?
Kind of between the two. you know, you can never say never. Never say never. Never say it's over.
Yeah.
Honestly, because there's something that may come along that tickles you and makes you really get hungry again. Making documentaries is quite a handful. I'm working on this clean energy documentary. It's a whole new world for me. Very interesting. Very interesting. You know, I had hopes for the book, but the New York Times kind of ambushed it. I mean, that was a horrible. the interview was an ambush. I talked to that guy 85% of the time about the book, and he was interested, and it was about the book. And then when it comes out, it's all politics overshadows.
But I didn't think it was bad. I mean,
there wasn't anything. There was nothing there about the book. It was all about
the book review in the New York Times was good. Ben Svecki wrote a nice review.
Yes, it was good. But I'm saying the interview was.
Yeah.
It was not intended to distract. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened in all these films we talked about. They take film away from me. They start with some bullshit about Oliver Stone says Hollywood's crazy, which is an end thought. You know, it's just like, wow, it seems like it's impossibly difficult to make a film in the old days, much less these days when you have to add people on staff and you have to have all kinds of things, you know, in order to get the approval. Do you think I could have blown all those bombs in Platoon or Salvador? I mean, it was insane. I was blowing them myself, the director. Now you'd have so many special effect guys around, you know, safety advisors, nurses, administrative insurance people. God, it's become a real overload of bureaucracy.
Well, I guess that era may be over, but I'm really glad we had it. And I thank you for the films and for doing this. I can't tell. And I really genuinely enjoyed the book. I want to thank you because I thought, you know, sometimes it's a chore to prep for these things. This was a pleasure. So thank you again. And really nice to meet you.
It was fun. Appreciate
it. Take care. Thank you.
Thanks very much for tuning into Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast for free and leave us a rating on iTunes or your podcast app, as well as on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/awardschatter. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. And you can follow all of my coverage between episodes at thr.com/the race. Until next time, thanks for joining us.